Welcome to the Enabled Disabled Podcast. I'm your host, Gustavo Serafini. I was born with a rare physical disability called PFFD. My journey has been about self-acceptance, persistence, and adaptation. On the show, we'll explore how people experience disability, how the stories we tell ourselves can both enable and disable, how vulnerability is the foundation for strength, and why people with disabilities can contribute more than we imagine. I hope that leaders, companies, clinicians, families, and friends will better understand our capacity to contribute to the world and help enable us to improve it. Viola Dwyer is a fellow graduate of Seth Godin's Alt MBA, a content creator, educator, and consultant. She's gone to some of the best schools in the country, worked in human resources for a national bank, and is currently the co-creator of a terrific YouTube channel called The Ginchiest. Viola and her husband Dan are on a mission to change the way people perceive disability. Their approach is clever, funny, and unafraid of exploring the depths of the disability experience. After the show, if you want to learn more about Viola, please come join our Facebook group at Enabled Disabled. Look forward to seeing you there. I know most people start with origin stories. I don't quite want to start there.
Okay.
I'd love to start talking about your YouTube channel, The Ginchiest, and kind of dive in a little bit into what you're doing there, why you started it, and what you're focusing on.
Yeah, so this is a love project, really, with my husband, Dan. And I first had the idea of doing a YouTube channel in general 7 years ago, now probably 8 years ago, because we're in 2021. And I was very hesitant for all those years to actually make it happen. But I think that after so much of seeing what the experiences of people with disabilities is like, and not really seeing other people talk about it openly, it was so glaringly apparent that these stories and our voices needed to be heard. And so I think that has been the main impetus for starting The Ginchiest. And why we exist is to really send this message that disability is a part of the human experience, and it's nothing to be afraid of, and it's nothing to be ashamed of. And so, you know, join us. We invite people into our lives so that they can see this for themselves and hopefully have this mind shift happen.
So my first question, I know the answer, but I think it's important for our audience to know, is why did you name it The Ginchiest? Because that is a really cool and interesting name.
I got to give Dan credit for that one, because Dan has really interesting slang words and phrases and just words that aren't often used. He'll say words like copacetic, and I'm like, okay, good egg, you're a good egg. He loves MASH. But he used to call me The Ginchiest, and he still does now, of course, because, you know, we're in love with that slang term. It comes from the 1950s, Gustavo. We think it started in this one song between Connie Stevens and Ed Burns, who are singing, and Ed says, "Baby, you're the ginchiest." It just means the coolest, the greatest. And we say, keep it ginchy, which means, you know, keep trying to be your best self. That is something we encourage people to do. And, you know, we believe in the human potential of being ginchy.
That's awesome. So did you, this came,
Dan got this idea, just you remember this movie that you both watched?
No, it was more like, I asked him, I said, what if we called it? Because we were going to go with the Danny and V show. I mean, it's like kind of boring. It doesn't really catch your ear. But what I asked him was, you call me the Ginchiest. What if we called it the Ginchiest? And we talked about it, and we thought about what that might look like. And it just kind of clicked. So we went from there. It was a joint effort for actually using it as our YouTube channel name.
That's awesome. And I've seen a bunch of the videos. I think you're both doing a fantastic job, and I think it just keeps getting better and better and better. I love how...
Well, thank you.
You give product reviews. So there's a product that may, you know, assist in your life in some way. And you give like a very honest review of, hey, you know, this works for these solutions, but I don't really like this about it. Right. Mm-hmm. So there was, which I think is really helpful. And I don't see a lot of that on, maybe none of that on YouTube. I haven't seen it, but you're also very open about discussing important topics around disability, important topics around your life, and that takes a lot of courage. So did you, I think you said that you've had the idea for a while, but kind of going through Seth Godin's Alt-MBA was another kind of inspirational point for launching it?
Absolutely. I think that just the whole experience of the Alt-MBA forces you, if you're open to it, to go very deep in whatever project or work that you have. And I was actually not going to choose the Ginchiest as the main focus. I thought, because at the time I had also just launched a business English virtual company and like teaching company, and I thought, oh, I'll just focus on that and try to build up that business. But then I realized pretty quickly after starting the Ginchiest that I don't even think I want to do the other work anymore. I mean, I'd still do it as a part-time job now, but I just love this so much more. And the people that I met through the Alt-MBA, and of course, as you know, like the cohort times, time together, it was so transformational, and it helped me really understand, okay, who is this going to be for? How are we going to, well, not how we're going to implement, but who's it for? You know, what's our why? So that's really the tough work that a lot of maybe creators or entrepreneurs don't take the time to do beforehand, but it's really vital.
Absolutely. One of the things that I was amazed at with the Alt-MBA was how safe the space was that they created, where we could be vulnerable with essentially strangers that we were just meeting that week and open up on some of our biggest fears, some of our deepest vulnerabilities, and just share them and actually learn that it was, if you do it right, it's a source of strength. It's not a weakness.
Yeah. I mean, I was really impressed with one prompt in particular that had to do with empathy. And I think that links to your point about being vulnerable, because it's, it really stretches those or flexes those empathy muscles and allows people to think from a different perspective. And that's, I mean, I'm so passionate about that. And it's, I have to say, my experience as a person with a disability has taught me to be okay with my vulnerability. And so that is not something I struggle with as much as, let's say, another person may. But just being with everyone and through that experience, and exercising still those empathy muscles, it really is a very special space and time to do the work.
What is there an episode or two of the Ginchias that you're most proud that you put out there?
Oh, that's a good question. I think that we're still really new still, but I think that one episode that was recent was the words that make us cringe. I really, as I mentioned, like I help people, at least right now, with English, the English language. And so words mean a lot to me. And I really am fascinated by language. And so I think that the way in which the words in which we use to refer to one another and communicate with one another are so important. And so I was worried. I mean, I am so worried about what the reception might be of these opinions, Dan's and my opinion about these words. But I'm also proud of putting it out there, because I think one thing that we made pretty clear is that these are our opinions, these are our experiences, and that people will have variations of that. We don't represent all of the disability world and the experience. So that was one. And then I think the other one was really for Dan, because we worked so hard on this episode, was Dan's disability story. He took a long time for him to sit down and finally film it, because it's a very sensitive topic for him. He acquired his disability. He wasn't born with it like I was. And so it was a traumatic event. And so we wanted to really honor his feelings towards that and be respectful in how we shared it with the world.
And I think that, I mean, I love that episode. It was really emotional for me. And, you know, I told you this before, but I think it merits repeating. Dan's story and the way you told it, the sensitivity, there was like a rawness to it, and it made me really appreciate not only what he's been through, but that he has a speech impediment now since his accident, and mm-hmm. that his act of speaking, his act of communicating to the world is it shows his courage, it shows his determination, it shows his desire to connect and his fighting spirit mm-hmm. in such a beautiful way that I just completely shifted my perspective.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really hard, I think, for people who do have like a type of speech impairment too, because they, I mean, not only do they at times need other people to show patience, but they themselves have to be extremely patient with other people. And I've seen that with Dan. I mean, he will repeat himself over and over again. And I just think to myself, my God, how, like, it's just so much. But it just shows you how, you know, we do have this reserve. We have this well of strength. I mean, some people are able to tap into it very easily. And I think that Dan is one of those people. And so, yeah, I give him a lot of kudos, because it's such a fundamental desire to be understood. And when that's compromised in some way, it's an incredibly unique challenge.
And so I was born with my disability, and you were too. How was your experience? You know, this adaptation process for you growing up? What did that look like?
Yeah, we haven't done my disability story. We're planning on doing it. We're trying to keep it even here. It's not all about Dan. But I will be saying, I mean, I do believe, because I've been thinking about this, is that in terms of how I've viewed my disability throughout the years, the word that comes to mind often is incredulity. Because, and my mom is like this, because one of her favorite phrases is, "I can't believe it." And, you know, to this day, Gustavo, there are times, I wouldn't say every day, of course, but there are times where I will have like a moment of shock where I think to myself, "I can't believe that this is my life." Like, whoa. Like, this is it. This is, you know, my reality. And I'm not evaluating this. I'm just kind of in this like weird state of like, whoa, this is, like, I kind of have to remind myself sometimes. And it's really weird because I think when I was younger, I wasn't fully aware that I was quite, you know, different, and society for the most part thought of me as different. And so it took me having that exposure to others who thought, you know, who received me in that way, for me to start getting that message that no, you are different. And then I worked so hard to try to assimilate and not be different. And so I think that that's why sometimes I have these moments of shock. I have to say, though, since doing this work and talking more openly about it, that I haven't had a shock moment in a while. So that's good.
That is good.
Maybe I'm coming to terms with reality at the age of 40 or something.
there's a lot to say there. So when did you start to... I know you mentioned before that one of your, I think it was elementary school, right, was one of the first times that you had seen other children with different kinds of disabilities. Is that correct?
Well, yeah. I mean, listen, but I will say that I have two older sisters, and one of whom had the same disease as I do. And so she was 5 years older than me. She passed away in 2019. And, you know, she was my main source of understanding that, like, of course, there are other people like me. It's my sister. But beside her, everyone else in my family didn't have a disability. Well, there was one other person. Actually, there was another person that a cousin, but I don't really know if I had met her when I was very, very young. But yes, when I went to, she had a developmental disability. But when I went to elementary school, I was only around other children with physical and developmental disabilities, and so it was. It was a big eye-opener in that regard because there was so much diversity of disability there.
What did that experience teach you, if you can remember? Like, what were the impressions that you still hold on to from that time that were important?
Yeah, some were very positive and some not. And so I'll start with the good, and then I made friends who I am still friends with to this day. And I also had teachers and administrators who really instilled in me that we can strive toward whatever goals we have in life. And they were incredibly supportive, incredibly kind to us and compassionate. I would say they were probably my favorite teachers out of all the teachers that I had through secondary schooling. The bad was that I saw a lot of neglect ignorance, in the sense that I would see some kids who were from families who, you know, they either families or institutions, I don't really know what their personal situations were, but they clearly didn't seem like they were well cared for. They smelled of urine. Their hair wasn't, groomed. Their clothing, you know, just didn't seem as clean as some other kids. I also saw some aides who were, I'm going to say it, like rather abusive when it came to helping in the bathroom and yelling. And I don't know if I saw hitting, but definitely this sense of like you're a burden and you're in a nuisance type attitude. And certainly made me not want to go to the bathroom during the day. And so I taught that skill really early too, because I did need assistance and I still do to use the restroom. But I never engaged with them voluntarily. Whether sometimes they would make you say you have to go to the bathroom. But yeah, those were really two dichotomies there. Yeah, because yeah, on one hand you're seeing wonderful people and such support, but then on the other, it was a hard thing to witness as a kid.
That is a hard thing. I can imagine. How did you, so what was your, besides trying not to go to the bathroom during the day, which is, not fun, like what was your adaptation process then? Like, what stories were you telling yourself as a kid, and how are you getting past that, or not even getting past that, but just coping with it?
Well, it's interesting. One story that my best friend at the time, her name is Angel, and she's a friend I'm still friends with, we would tell ourselves was that when we grow up, we're going to have our own apartments and our own careers, and we won't have our disabilities anymore. And we were convinced of this, and we would plan, and we would dream, and we would come up with all these different things that we would do, and all this together, of course, because we were so happy to be together. And she and I talk about this, and we're like, wow, can you believe it? Like, that was a coping mechanism for us. It was a way for us to think, okay, we can make it through this, and if we make it through this, then all will be better in the future. And it did get better, except the big major part of it didn't go away, but I mean, we still have our friendship, and that's huge. Yeah.
Absolutely. So that for me, one of my coping mechanisms was, I mean, I only saw people like me when I went to the doctor, when I went to the, the Shriners Children's Hospital, wherever it was. And so for me, it was easier to say, I'm here, but as soon as I leave and, I get my prosthetics taken care of or whatever it is that we're doing today, I can go back to, quote unquote, normal life, right? Mm-hmm. Where my friends kind of accept me for who I am and disability doesn't really come up. I'm just trying to fit in and trying to make people like me and just live, kind of live where it's ignored, where it's just kind of this thing that sits in the background and it only kind of rears its head once in a while.
Yeah, I know. I relate to that. That resonates with me because that, when I did leave that school, the elementary school, I went to what they call a mainstream school. And it sounds like you were always in mainstream schools where the other kids didn't have disabilities. And so it's interesting because I think I was also fortunate in that my older sister eventually went to the same school, this mainstream school, and there was a neighborhood friend who had the same disease even as me who also went there. So I wasn't the only one, and that did make it easier. But I do think that there's this feeling of, I mean, every teenager, I think, for the most part, has this want of fitting in, of being accepted. But it's really pronounced for someone with a disability. And so I did do a lot of those things of trying to downplay my disability, and that would look like not talking about it. I'm not going to talk about my illness. I'm not going to explain why I couldn't go back to school for 3 weeks when I fell out of my wheelchair. You know, I came back to notes that were, now today we would call that bullying, but it was like just real immaturity. Kids just saying really mean things about me not, you know, going to school for 3 weeks because I was ill, but I didn't take the time to, or I wasn't, I was a kid too, you know, and that's a lot to ask of a kid to educate other kids. So I would imagine, and correct me if I'm wrong, because I would love to hear your experience on this too, that, you know, you didn't do that. I mean, it was way easier to just hide it under the rug and not talk about it and try to fit in as best as you possibly can.
I think my friends, we had the conversation in the beginning. So it was like, okay, let's get this out of the way. I was born this way.
Interesting.
Like,
okay.
Give me a chance kind of thing. And I'll show you that, like, I can be one of the cool kids, right? I can play basketball with you or handball or whatever. Or, you know, I would have a group of friends that we would just second and third grade just be, we got the talk out of the way with, and then they either accepted me or they didn't, right? So if they did, then we became friends and we didn't talk about it again. Or it was like, hey, let's make, say we were playing handball. So I couldn't, obviously, I have, you know, my mobility was a lot more constrained than other kids. So they'd say, all right, Gus gets 2 bounces on the handball, right? So it was like they tried to accommodate in a way that made me feel included. Mm. That also made it like I was part of the group. Or we'd play just imagination games. Or I remember one time, and the teachers had so much to do with that, because I, like, second grade, third grade, I had some amazing teachers who went the extra, and assistant teachers who went that extra step to make me feel included and to make me feel like part of the group. So, you know, we would do plays and I would be part of the plays, and we would do, you know, we'd play tag. And I still remember to this day, like, I had already gotten caught, and basically you're running from one side to the other. And if you grab that person's hand and run with them to the other side, they're safe again. And there was this girl who grabbed my hand, and I was like, no, we're not going to make it. And she was like, yes, you are. We're totally going to make it. Let's go. And she just, like, you know, dragging me to the other side. So good kids that, like, were able to kind of open their minds. It was great. The people that didn't accept it, then we just kind of left each other alone.
And when they made that accommodation for you, your friends, with the, okay, Gus gets 2 bounces, was it? Did you feel included when they did that? I mean, how did you feel about it?
I felt like I'm going to try to, you know, get it on 1 bounce as much as I can. But if I get 2 bounces, then so be it. I still get to compete. And it puts us a little bit more on equal grounds. So, you know, as I got older and as I got better at certain things, that kind of went away. But but growing up, I think it was an important accommodation. It didn't make me feel bad. It made me feel like, like I can, they're giving me a chance to play with them.
Makes sense.
So how is, it's, I think that as you progress then through, right, through your education, were there any like key points in time where you felt better is not the word I'm looking for, but you felt like I've turned a corner on how I see myself, or I'm feeling like, you know, like when you and your friend were saying, we're going to have our own careers, we're going to have our own apartments, right? Like, did that, you know, was college something that was more, that started to look like more of a reality? Were there key moments in time where you felt like it was going to happen?
Yes, absolutely. Because I have to say that when I did make that shift to, let's quote unquote, mainstream school, it was fine for the first couple of years, but when adolescence hit for everyone, I was really depressed and I just wasn't a happy kid. So going to college, and I specifically went away for college, I moved out of state, was a transformative time for me, thankfully, because I was a bit, thinking back on that experience, I really was at a really dark place. But it was wonderful for me to have that greater autonomy, greater independence. I was learning things that I chose. I chose my classes. I loved most of my teachers, my professors, and I met wonderful people. I was really trying to be thoughtful in the groups that I joined. I joined a community service group called Circle K, and I loved it. And I met one of my very, very good friends today still there. And I was able to go to a lot of friends' apartments. Well, I had my own dorm, which I thought of as an apartment. It was very freeing. It was a really freeing time. And I think that it represented what I think that college experience represents for a lot of young adults. It's a time to explore, emotionally, physically. And I just am very grateful for that time.
I think the diversity of the student body in college was something that took me by surprise. I was meeting people from all over the world that I had never had that experience, and just getting different people's perspectives. And you know, it was college for me is the same thing. It was, I went out of state and it was empowering and challenging, and I had to deal with Chicago weather, coming from Los Angeles.
Oof, that must have been tough.
It was worth it. But I think the coming together of the group of friends that I'm still friends with, I'm still in pretty close contact with some from college to this day, was, we just became more close-knit because of that. Those shared experiences and those shared challenges. Teenage years, I think, are just generally tough for most people. Unless you're one of the cool kids, it's just difficult for just about everyone.
It's amazing. Though sometimes I look at the news and I just think, did we ever leave high school? Like, really, ever? Because I really wonder that sometimes. But yes, some do. The good news is that some do.
Some of us do, exactly. And so when did you get your first, first part-time job? When did you do that?
Yeah. So it's a really neat story. So I went to Johns Hopkins as an undergrad, and I had seen a whole bunch of posters that said, MD PERG and PERG this, PERG PERG. And PERG is a nonprofit public interest research group, and they have it in every state, maybe not, but they definitely had one in PA. And so I was like, okay, I'm going to apply for this. One makes some extra money. like a lot of other people do in their summer vacations. And it was the summer vacation right after my freshman year in college. And I went to the downtown office and I had applied. I don't remember how I applied, but I did. And I was going for the interview. Now, I knew that it was for canvassing, which meant that I would have to go to different people's homes and basically ask for money. And I thought, well, maybe I could do it. I mean, if it was like a certain neighborhood and like, I don't know. But honestly, I really couldn't because most homes are not accessible, especially in the Philadelphia area. So anyway, I go to this place and I think that there's like a phone bank. Maybe I could work on the phone. Well, when I'm in the interview, the hiring manager says, you're going to have to be able to go to people's homes. How are you going to do that? And I was honest. I said, well, you know, I think it might be an issue. A lot of homes are inaccessible. And he's like, well, I'm sorry, but this is the job. You know, all the best to you. And I thought, oh, man, like, this is it. I'm not going to get this job. And I was waiting. I left the building and I waited. And there was this girl that I had spoken to very casually who was working at definitely at the same organization, but I didn't really know what department. And she was on her smoke break. She's like, well, what were you here for? And I said, I was going for the canvassing job. And she's like, well, why don't you just, you know, be a phone rep? I'm on the phones. And I'm like, well, I don't know if they would consider me for that. So she went to the hiring manager and she said, why aren't you considering her for phones? She could totally do the phones. And I was like floored by her openness, her willingness to advocate for me. Like, I'm this young kid. I didn't know what the heck. It was the first interview really ever that I was seriously, you know, being considered for. I did like informational interviews before this, but nothing like a real interview. And I got the job because of her. Her name was Leslie. Thank you, Leslie. So, you know, it just shows how important we can help, like how important it is to think of others and we can be an advocate at any moment in our day in a variety of ways. And she was one. She helped me have like a real experience that summer, exposure to my first job. So yeah.
That's an amazing story. I didn't even know that. Like, that's
yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah.
So, yeah. That's it. To me, the key point there is what you said. You can always be an advocate for somebody, but I think it's the ability to see what people can bring to the table, right? Not in spite of. Just, we all have things that we're good at. We all have things that we excel at if we're given the opportunity to show it. And she saw like, hey, you can totally do this job. I bet, you know, why aren't they hiring you for this? That's phenomenal. Yeah. Like, yes, yeah. Because that's what made sense. That's where you fit and where you could contribute.
Yeah. I tell you, well, it's so frustrating because many years later, when I became an HR manager, I saw this still. I saw this attitude of like, oh no, this peg doesn't fit in that hole. Sorry, we can't extend this offer to that person, or that we can't even interview this person. And it's very narrow thinking. And I remember talking with other HR hiring managers about reconsidering all of the job descriptions through this lens of adaptability. Can we think of this job being done in a little bit more, like, are there alternatives for this job to get done? Like, does it have to be in this way? And there was a lot of resistance, sadly to report. There was a lot of resistance and doing that type of work. It never got done, at least when I was promoting it. And so, but yeah, I mean, one person that one day made a difference, and that's what mattered in that moment. But I wish it happened more often. And I wish the people broadened their views about what can be done. And yeah, so
it's a shame that I see this in my work too. I'd love to. I want to talk about your experience as an HR manager, because that's super, super juicy topic there. But the people tend, not all people, obviously, but people tend to stop. They see a problem and they stop. And it's like, okay, there's a problem here. Let's either look somewhere else, or let's not figure out how to solve it. It's a problem. You know, it's time, it's money, it's whatever goes on in their brain. They don't dig any deeper. And that frustrates the heck out of me. And that's something that, as my one theory that I have is that people with disabilities, we can't stop at the problem. We have to figure out how to make it work. We have to figure out how to adapt. We have to figure out ways around it or through it, or right shifting perspectives, whatever it is. We don't stop at the problem. And I think that's one of our greatest skill sets, that it's a Seth Godin soft skill, but it's a really, really, really important one that I wish more companies would realize.
Yeah, me too. Really. Yes.
So HR manager, how long did you do it for?
It wasn't for very long. So, I mean, after business school, I joined a bank, and I was doing HR work, but in my last year there, it was about a little under 4 years, but I was responsible for a lot of hiring in the last year. That wasn't I wasn't like, a talent manager, but as a manager of operations, HR operations, we had to grow the team a lot. And then I was also on another project that had to do with, and this was years prior, still at the same company, for job descriptions. And that's the instance that I was talking about earlier. But yeah, I mean, I think recruiters especially are just eager to fill a wreck. They just want to hurry up and move on to the next person or the next job. And I mean, not all recruiters are like this, but they're so overworked, I would say, and overwhelmed. And I'm sure that COVID isn't making that any easier. But it's when, and I think that there's this impression that to consider the diversity initiatives of a company through the recruiting lens, that would be a lot of work. And so there's this hesitation because, you know, I think a lot of companies in theory have good intentions. They want to move the needle in hiring more people with disabilities. They want to move the needle in hiring more African Americans and other people of minority groups. But it's like they're also tremendously risk averse, and they see, I think, some of these initiatives and work as risky. Delving into the litigious, potential. And I just think you're overanalyzing it. You're making something that could be a win-win, as we say in the business world, and overcomplicating it and making it more difficult, bureaucratic. So, yeah, I wish I had happier stories, because now I don't.
So what did your hiring process look like at this bank? Were you like one of those students where, you know, your grades were so good and your teacher recommendations were so good, and you were too good to be ignored? So like, of course they were going to hire you? Like, well, what did that look like?
Kind of, yeah. I think my schooling carried a lot because they recruited specifically from the Fuqua School of Business at Duke. And so, and they were also looking to check off some diversity boxes. But I think that it was clear to me, at least, that my school, my degree background held a lot of weight. And it wasn't very difficult to get considered. I mean, they found me in this resume book and invited me to a series of interviews, and I did those interviews. Now, I will say that after I left that company and I took a break, I resigned from that company and wanted to try different things and also step back from the corporate world. And when I tried to get back in, I was shocked by the reception that I had. I mean, I knew that things were changing recruiting-wise for a number of years, but I didn't think that discrimination would play a role in my experience. But it was clear to me that it did in some instances, where I was, the finalist in a job that I thought I was a shoo-in for. And I did some investigation work on LinkedIn, and I realized that they went for a person who was younger and less experienced. And I also wondered, and I don't know the answer of this for sure, because we never really know, that when because I felt like there was a shift when I met the person, the hiring manager in person, when the person finally got to see me. And my disability is very visible. I use a power wheelchair. It's very obvious. I just felt that the person wasn't as warm, wasn't as talkative. Maybe this person had already made the decision. I don't know, but it makes you wonder. It made me wonder many times because I spent too many years trying to get back in. I just decided, no, I don't think this isn't good for my health, emotional ones, and physical to keep doing this. And then we started the Ginjia, so now I'm happy. But yeah.
Where do you think that shift, where did that shift come from? Where did you feel like it started to change? You think it was at the corporate level, or you think it's just specific HR people? Because clearly you had no issues getting a great job out of school.
Yeah, I mean, there are a number of factors, of course, when anyone's being considered for a job. I think that one major one, and I'll be totally honest, is that I didn't have, I made a career shift when I left business school. I didn't have a ton of years of experience in HR. And I learned very quickly that is not worked fondly. And people will discredit your transferable skills, as we say. So I think that was a big factor. And then because I had all this other experience and mid-level roles that I held, it was difficult for other employers who maybe wanted to hire me, but they felt like I would be getting a huge pay cut. But at this point, looking for a job for over a year, I was willing to get a pay cut. I don't know if they maybe didn't believe me or what, but again, like there were a lot of factors. I think the main one though was that I wanted to stay in HR, and they didn't have enough of that experience. But I do wonder too whether it had to do with the disability, because Dan and I, when we got married, we moved from Philadelphia, where we're from, to Phoenix, Arizona. And we spent 9 months there, and we would go to career fair after career fair. And they had various levels of jobs at this career fair. And of course, they see you in person. And I did get some momentum, but I wondered, you know, what, and people would always tell me, like they would often tell me, oh, your resume is so impressive. Well, if it's so impressive, then why aren't you really considering me then? Like I've done all that you asked. So it was frustrating. But again, like I will never know. You can't say for sure what's going through these people's minds. And is it discrimination? I don't know. Is it because of the HR lack of experience? I don't know. So
I have a small business and mm-hmm. I haven't hired a lot of people, but I've hired enough. Thankfully, I've only had to let go of one person in 15 years, which is good.
Amazing.
How would I approach, right, hiring somebody with a disability? Mm. And I think I would do really well at that, because if you can do the work and I think you're a good fit, you can do the work, right?
Yeah.
That's like, I'm not going to ask, I'm not going to hire Viola to go install televisions and run wire, but I'm not going to do that myself either. That's totally right. Okay.
Yeah.
But I would love to have more diversity, more perspectives, mm-hmm. more, like, to me, the key is, what is this person going to bring to the organization? What are mm-hmm. they going to contribute of value that we don't have right now?
Yeah.
And I wish more people saw it that way.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah. So. Well, that's why we're here. We're going to work on that.
Exactly. We're going to, exactly. 100%.
We're working on that. So.
My last question for you.
Yes.
Is, what did I miss that you would love to talk about?
Wow, you're putting me on the spot. Mm. I don't know. I feel like I've been doing this a lot, that I talk so much recently, and it's wonderful. And I'm so grateful for these opportunities to talk about these topics. They're so important. I would say this, that, I mean, maybe it's me being hyper idealistic, because my husband thinks that, I'm pretty sure he's convinced that I'm a bit of like an uber idealist. But I do believe that if people took the time, and I don't care who you are, where you are in the world, if people took the time to learn about disability, it has the power to reflect back your humanity. And it can change you and the world. Because fundamentally, Gustavo, we are very fragile beings, all of us. Some more obviously fragile than others. But we have tremendous hubris into thinking that we're powerful and we're all-knowing or we're in total control. And I just think, what a disillusion, like, what a bubble. So I encourage people to learn about disability. It's so vital.
And what are some of the ways that they can engage with people with disabilities or learn about it, besides the Ginchiest?
I was about to say, hello. Exactly. Watch the Ginchiest. Subscribe. Listen to this podcast. Subscribe. I mean, that's really what people can do to start out with. Of course, link with other groups who are trying to gain understanding, you know, Black Lives Matter movement. I mean, it's seeing other people and not ignoring them and reaching out and asking them, you know, like trying to form a relationship with them. It is a bit odd if you were to just come up to a disabled person and be like randomly asking a whole bunch of questions of them. But the point is to extend yourself, because we have a horrible tendency to want to associate with only people like ourselves. This is hurting us. This is building a very contentious world. And what I want to say to people is that, you know, push yourself. I'm not saying that you have to be best friends with the girl in the wheelchair, but you know, did you ever ask her, like, how are you doing? Or did you ever ask her, did you ever try to form a relationship, even if it's an acquaintance level type of relationship? I mean, these are the steps that people can do. I mean, and of course, surround yourself with really great content that we've already mentioned so that you can learn on your own as well.
Are there any books that you've read that you thought were key in this area?
Yeah. So one book, and I wish I had, you know, heard back from him, but he's this ABC, he used to be a reporter on ABC News, John Hockenberry, and he wrote a book called Moving Violations. But this is one of my first books on the disability experience, and it blew my mind. It's one of the most honest and entertaining autobiographies that I've read. So that one I highly recommend. Even though he never got back to me. I'm just going to be honest. I really would have appreciated, you know, the response, but that's okay. John, I know you're busy. And the other one recently was called Disability Visibility by Alice Wong. And Alice is a huge disability activist. She's big on Twitter. And this book is a compilation of very diverse stories of disability. And, you know, I think it does a great job in giving people a really wide range of understanding the disability experience.
Thank you for sharing that. I think what you said is absolutely beautiful and correct. And I would encourage people to definitely get on your YouTube channel and engage with that. Subscribe, like, you know, get the notification button going, all that stuff. But what I had a professor who used to say that too, where I would come in, you know, I was taking a graduate level course in undergrad and philosophy course, and I'd come in and I'd criticize the philosopher, right? Instead of engaging with content, it's like, okay, let me criticize something about this philosopher's background or private life that I didn't like. And the professor would just say, look, that doesn't change whether or not he was right. Like, engage with the arguments, engage with thinking, don't judge the person. And that got me out of and the other thing he would say is what you said, we're all fallible, we're all weak. You know, we're all human. So let's engage as best we can in, right now we're studying somebody's thinking. Let's engage with thinking and let's evaluate that on its own. I would say let's evaluate people on some slightly deeper levels than just what we see on the surface and what we think we know about that person in 5 seconds of judging. Let's take that animal response, put it on the back burner, right, for a little bit, and think with our brains and say, how can we actually, it's responding versus reacting, and see people a little bit more deeply and a little bit more intelligently and engage with them and what they're here, what they're here to contribute and share. And we don't do that enough.
Thank you, Gustavo, for having me again.
You're very welcome. Viola, thank you so much for being here, and I look forward to more episodes down the road.